when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, the editor of CapEx. This week, I was delighted to welcome Peter Pomerantsev to CapEx Towers. Peter is one of the world's leading writers on propaganda and fake news, and has even given evidence to the US Congress on Russian disinformation. He boasts a fascinating and varied CV, having spent many years working as a TV producer in Putin's Russia, an experience he documented in gripping style in his first book, Nothing is Real and Everything is Possible. And if you haven't read that, I thoroughly recommend it. We sat down to discuss his latest book, This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality, in which Peter travels the world, finding out how despots and demagogues are twisting the truth, and how we can start to fight back. Peter, thank you very much for joining us on Free Exchange. Now, you've recently written a book called This Is Not Propaganda, which we're going to come on to later in great depth. But first of all, do you want to tell us a little bit about your own background? Because you were born in, the Soviet Union and moved to the UK, lived in Germany, then you went back to Russia. It's been quite a sort of diverse life you've led.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a wandering life, but sort of centred around the UK, so quite right. I was born in Kiev in 1977, but my father was a Soviet dissident and he was arrested for the heinous crime of distributing books by Vladimir Nabokov and Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which seems absurd now, doesn't it? But then it was you'd get 7 years of prison, 5 years of exile for such a heinous crime. But it was a period when the Soviet regime was actually getting rid of a lot of dissidents. If it was less of a bother to get rid of them than making them martyrs a lot of the time. So there was a small immigration at that point, and we ended up in Britain, actually, in London. My father worked at the Russian service of the BBC, so I was very much a child of Bush House. All my earliest memories are in Bush House, where the World Service is. Okay. And there's a lot about that in my new book, kind of memories of the Cold War Bush House. So I grew up here, but then my father went on to work in Munich, so I lived there for a bit and went to a very strange and interesting and really inspiring institution called the European School, which was a special set of schools created by Jean Monnet and the founders of the EU, largely meant for EU Eurocrats, but also for open to others, which were kind of specially designed to create a new kind of European human. And if you want, we can get into that story. But then, you know, then I went to, you know, I was a classical Oxbridge reject, went to Edinburgh, where actually I learned a lot about Britain, which I'd never understood before as an immigrant to London. I'd never really understood that the extent to which the English were hated, and quite justifiably so. And then, yes, after university, I went to Russia, went back to Russia, and spent 9 years there and worked in television, making entertainment programs in Russia, bringing reality shows and stand-up comedy and factual entertainment to the culture of Tolstoy and Trotsky, which was, you know, a really interesting way to look at the emergence of a new kind of media-powered authoritarianism, which I described in my first book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. Now I'm back in London. I run a think tank at the London School of Economics, which analyzes propaganda and it's called Arena, yes, yeah. Yes. Okay. Analyzes sort of disinformation campaigns, especially in the digital era, and also thinks about and experiments with pioneering ways to save deliberative democracy, essentially, which I'm a little bit worried about.
Yeah, indeed. And your latest book, so your first book is very much focused on Russia, lots of quite incredible tales of dealing with gangsters and gold-digging women and so on. But this book's much more global in its scope, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, so the first one is a memoir of my time in Russia. And at the end of that book, I kind of come back to the West and sort of say, well, Russia's messed up, but still the West is different. Because in Russia, I try to sort of describe a system, a propaganda system, that was very different to the old Soviet one. I mean, it wasn't one that tried to kind of affirm a higher truth. Quite the opposite, it worked by sort of spreading doubt and kind of arguing that truth is unknowable in almost a kind of postmodern way. But sort of with the continuing argument that, you know, therefore all truth is subjective and all facts are just interpretations. And in this dark, messy world where there's nothing to fight for, no values, no ideals, and everything's a dark conspiracy, you need a strong hand to guide you. And it was a propaganda where there was no kind of a, very interesting, where politicians didn't care if they were caught lying. You know, that was the agony of my friends who worked in journalism in Russia. And the little bits of independent journalism that, you know, they would find the evidence against Putin or his various cronies about their corruption, they'd find it and show it, and you know, people would not care, or if anything, the politicians would say, hey, we don't care about the facts, you know, we don't even care if you catch us lying, and they would openly contradict themselves all the time, and it didn't matter. And I kind of came back to the West saying, okay, you know, the West is messed up in its own ways, but at least we have a rational politics and we can hold politicians accountable with the truth, and we have clear ideas of, you know, left and right and rational debate and all these things. And then lo and behold, I see quite a lot of the sort of rhetorical manifestations and propaganda manifestations that I saw in Russia appear here. And the second book was trying to an attempt to understand, is that systemic? And if it's systemic, why? So you're quite right, I go across the world, or around the world, because it's not flat, it's round, I've discovered. And
depending on who you believe.
Well, you know, I'm sticking with the round bit for the moment. But yeah, I go to South Asia, I go to China, Latin America. I blew my advance. I mean, my wife's quite annoyed.
I mean, what was the genesis of the book? Was there a particular moment? Did it feel like a natural progression from the first book to, you know, right, well, I've done Russia, now let's see how this model, what you might call the kind of Surkov model, has expanded?
Yeah. It was very consciously a continuation of the first book. So, you know, you can read the second one without knowing the first one, but anyone who's read the first one will realize that, you know, I'm again treating myself as the main narrator, but very much as a character. And the character's grown up. So, you know, like in an Updike book. No, joking. But like in the first one, I'm a young man. I'm in Moscow having a lot of adventures, and it's very much a young man goes abroad sort of book. But I hope undermining that deeply fatuous genre at the same time. While the second one is me really grown up, working really as, I think I describe, a kind of a minor foot soldier of the Cold War liberal establishment or post-Cold War liberal establishment. You know, I work in the university. I, you know, write little bullet point filled papers for, you know, international institutions and governments and media conglomerates. So, you know, I'm very much like, you know, a small Kafkaesque character in the crumbling edifice of the liberal order.
I mean, which of those, you mentioned a few different countries, are there, which are the kind of incidents or the people you met that really stood out for you or shocked you, perhaps?
That's a very good question. In a way, the most memorable stuff for me in the book, and I'm biased, is the family memoir. So I interlace what's going on across the world with the family story, with my parents' story, and my own childhood. Because my parents, as I said at the start, they were kind of Soviet dissidents, and they ended up fighting for the values that constituted our idea of freedom in a democratic information space. So freedom of expression, media pluralism, kind of artistic idea of the self as being able to express themselves. You know, they were arrested for these things. And when my father worked at the BBC World Service, he kind of became a, you know, a propagandizer of these ideals. He doesn't mind being called that. And I contrast that with today's world, where freedom of expression has been turned on its head in a media environment where you now, you know, you don't try to censor people if you're a government, whether in Russia or China or America for that reason. You flood the information space with so much information, people don't know what's truth and false anymore. So freedom of expression has kind of like been used to drown out any chance of ever getting to the truth. And media pluralism has kind of tipped into hyperpolarization, where societies can't talk to each other, to themselves anymore. So I kind of contrast sort of what my parents were fighting for and how all these ideals have been turned inside out. But I recommend to anyone to actually interview their parents one time, because one grows up knowing stories and kind of myths. But it's only when you actually interview your parents in a very disciplined way that you start to understand the depth of experience. And that, for me, was the most interesting thing. I really recommend it to everyone. I don't mean skeletons or anything like that. It's just you actually start to, you know, these things stop being stories that your parents told you. And you start to get a sense of the massiveness of their experience. So that's something I recommend everyone to do, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we talked. One of the countries you mentioned was China, and I wonder what your reflections are on the system that they are still, I think, in the process of building, in terms of not just controlling their own population, but also disseminating certain ideas beyond their borders in the way that Russia has.
So they have. China is now seen as kind of the forefront of a way of maximizing the authoritarian power of the internet, but not purely through kind of top-down censorship, but by, you know, through the power of AI, essentially, by analyzing everything that you do, from, like, you know, how much wine you buy in the evenings in a store, through whether you visit your parents, through what you say politically, and combining that into a sort of a citizenship score, if you're a good boy, you'll progress, and if you're a bad girl, you'll go down. So that's, you know, that's kind of a way of kind of institution control into people's heads. That's still being experimented with, but that's kind of the model they've set out. And of course, it's not so far away from the Silicon Valley dream of a purely kind of techno-driven, technocratic society where democracy is just kind of like sort of useless and slow and flawed and inefficient. Yeah. And why would you do that? So it's almost like they've latched onto the latent promise of the internet, when we'd always thought there was going to be a liberatory and emancipatory force. So that's a big deal. And I suppose the really scary thing about that, apart from like the way it destroys rights, is that it may deliver pleasure and efficiency. Because back in the old days, in the Cold War, it was clear that the free model was also more efficient and more fun and more pleasurable. And it was attractive. While I suppose the argument the Chinese are making, yes, it will be authoritarian, but my God, it'll be so much better. You know, you'll be able to shop so much better. You'll find online university courses so much better because we know everything about you. We will give you the best form of education possible, best medical services. I mean, what they're promising is kind of efficiency and comfort and pleasure along with authoritarian control. Something I worry about a lot nowadays is whether we can still express the pleasure of democracy. We can explain probably why it's important in terms of rights, to have rights kind of abstractly. But what if their system is more pleasurable? And that's sort of a challenge that I think we really need to answer.
Yes, I think... Yeah.
That wasn't your question. You were beyond their borders. So the Russians are a bit... I mean, the Chinese keep a very careful eye on what the Russians are doing, but they're playing a different game. I mean, the Russians are playing giant troll, which is a kind of a strategy that's very effective for today's global information marketplace, where you don't have to have that much real power as long as you have attention. Mm-hmm. And Russia has got very good at getting attention by essentially trolling the West in various forms, whether through information campaigns or through, you know, very real bombing campaigns, but very targeted ones. I mean, the ones they choose are there to show up how weak we are. I mean, the stuff in Syria, partly about Syria, much more about saying, you know, the West, they're weak. Russia has got very good at that. China's playing a slightly different game because they're playing a longer game. They want to be seen as a reliable partner throughout a lot of the world. So they're not as aggressive in their campaigns. Where they are aggressive is Taiwan, where they do very similar stuff to the Russians. They have troll armies. They go on Facebook pages and, you know, attack politicians they don't like. So they do it in Taiwan. And, of course, Hong Kong is becoming a flashpoint. That's somewhere where I think really the data's only being collected now to see whether they're starting to use Russia-like techniques. But they do it domestically. So domestically, of course, they have their own troll armies, known as the 50 Cent Army, who, like the Russian troll factories, go online, and their job is to kind of confuse, divert attention, certain amount of censorship, drown out. So they've been using those techniques domestically that the Russians have for a while as well.
And I wonder, obviously your background's working in TV. You said you worked for about 10 years or so. In Russia.
I was doing all the stuff as well.
And it strikes me, I mean, having read your first book especially, that Things have moved on since then in terms of the way that this information is broadcast. Which do you think is the most sort of insidious of these formats, or do they all have their own? Mm. So is it Facebook, is it Twitter, or is it traditional TV news or papers? Or?
It's a great question. Yeah, you're right. My first book is about TV. I work in TV and it's about a TV model, while the second book is much more about the internet. I actually think a lot of these, the TV to internet dynamic, in many ways, hasn't always been contradictory, quite the opposite. If you look at something we talk about a lot and think about a lot, which is a question of polarization and what are known as echo chambers, which is a terrible metaphor because they're not chambers and they're not echoey, but we kind of know what we mean. People living in their own...
Silos is
another one. They're all faulty, these metaphors, because actually information isn't like architecture. So a lot of academics spend a lot of time going, well, it's not technically a chamber. But we kind of know what we mean. The fracturing of a common public space and the fracturing of a common perception of reality. So there's great studies now by MIT, by Yochai Benkler, who's one of the premier researchers of the information space in America, showing, you know, this fragmentation in America, where it's much more extreme than here, really starts with cable news and talk radio. But then what social media does, it kind of just like pushes it even further. So if your old Fox News watcher would still sometimes like go back to CBS or New York Times, social media just pushed it further and further and further. And it made the Fox News of this world even more extreme because it pushed it further. Now, there I do think that something in the technology is part of this, because, you know, there's been plenty of studies about group polarization theory, but as long as the aim is attention, you go online in order to get likes and shares. In order to get more likes and shares than a group, you take the more extreme positions. So there is something about the way that social media has been designed which furthers taking extreme positions. So certainly doesn't further like taking mild positions or the truth or being reasonable and discursive. It really favors politicians who then play into that kind of scandalous and extremist rhetoric. I mean, there's a reason why Salvini and Trump and all these guys do so well online. So it's really, I think, a case of social media taking the worst of TV and then putting it on steroids. Now, the question is why they did that. And part of it, one explanation I have, which is kind of one that I take with a pinch of salt, but I think is worth mentioning. So we talked about I worked on reality shows. So when reality shows started, back at the start of The Apprentice and Big Brother, people actually worked together. Contestants were quite cooperative. You know, they didn't fight necessarily. And TV producers were like, oh my God, this is a nightmare. We need a bit of drama for ratings. And so people like myself would kind of engineer situations where fighting became sort of inevitable. You know, we engineered conflict. Even more so, we cast people who were bad guys and who were self-scandalous and extremist. We had a Trump-like personality, dare I say. And remember when sort of like all these sort of negative characters started doing well on reality shows. And that was a real cultural breakthrough, because before that, the good guy was meant to do well. Suddenly, it was good to be bad because people couldn't stop watching it. And, you know, and that became the norm. Compare the first season of The Apprentice and much later seasons. I mean, it went from casting quite serious people who were interested in a career and business to, it's a bit of a freak show, really.
Yeah, Katie Hopkins, kind of the archetype of what you're talking about. Started on The Apprentice and is now...
Yes. Yeah.
Well, she is what she is.
Exactly. But we kind of managed to make people think that that's normal behavior. And I wonder whether Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey and all these weird amoral geniuses were designing social media. They were so kind of full of the sense that that kind of behavior is normal, is reality. They ended up designing social media in a way that is a giant reality show. Social media rewards being nasty and as extreme as possible and hateful rhetoric and sort of self-scandalization. You know, you get attention through doing ridiculous things, which in another media context would just have made you look stupid. But now it's like, oh, no, you want to do that. You want to do crazy stuff that makes you look ridiculous because you'll keep attention. And once you've got that, then everything else falls into place. So it's almost like if you, like Scooby-Doo, when you take off the mask of Mark Zuckerberg, you finally see Simon Cowell. We live in Simon Cowell's world. We're completely surrounded by it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Now, I mean, it's a very difficult question for anyone to answer. But, I mean, what do you think some of the ways out of this are? I mean, as an individual, we can log off. We can delete our account and so on. But it's quite unlikely everybody's going to do that at the same time. So, I mean, it's kind of a bit of a liberal's dilemma, isn't it? If you advocate free speech, but then that obviously has these negative impacts as well. I mean, where is that line, and how do we start to deal with this problem?
So I think the thing that an individual can do very much is a bit of a nonsense, really. There are kind of structural issues which need to be changed. So on the regulation front and the free speech stuff, I agree. Actually, it's very interesting looking at the white paper that the British government put out, the white paper on online harms, which was a mad collage of many things. You can find great things in it. You can find bizarre things in it. But it established something called legal but harmful speech. Yeah? So stuff which is legal. It's not illegal speech. It's not sort of threats to violence or defamation, which already exist as legal categories. Legal but harmful, where they included things like disinformation, fake news, whatever you want to call it, bots, trolls, that whole thing. Foreign influence campaigns. And the people who were up in arms around it were freedom of expression organizations like Article 19 and Index on Censorship. They're like, there is no such thing as legal but harmful. You know, there is nothing in Article 19 of the Declaration of Human Rights, which is the one about freedom of expression, to say that disinformation is illegal. However, I do actually think we face a different form of censorship today, which is about our lack of understanding and our lack of control over how our information space is designed. So we don't know if something online is a real person or a Kremlin bot army or a Dominic Cummings troll army. We just don't know. There is no transparency on the internet. We don't know why an algorithm shows us one piece of content and not another. We don't know which of our own data is used to target us and why. We don't know when we see one ad from an official or unofficial campaign, because we don't actually know who's behind it. We don't know what ads they're showing our neighbor up the road. So we have no way to actually even criticize or engage with an election campaign. So this, we're kind of in the dark. We're like Caliban on Prospero's Island, surrounded by these kind of like, you know, these ghouls and spirits of information, disinformation that we don't understand. So I think we do need more freedom of expression. Freedom of expression is not just the freedom to say things, it's the freedom to receive information. So I think we do need radically more aggressive regulation to create a transparent internet. And with teeth. So if you keep on doing deceptive campaigns online, then that's illegal. They get taken down. That's not the same thing as anonymity. Anonymity is fine. A person can be anonymous for whatever reason. We're not talking about individuals here. We're talking about coordinating mass campaigns. That's the problem. And we have to have public oversight of algorithms. So Donald Trump's White House is already saying the 2020 elections in America will be rigged because Google pushes liberal news up and conservative down. Yeah, and the thing is, we don't know. We have no idea. Yeah. We have absolutely no idea. So this trust is getting away from us. Look, Facebook are taking some steps towards it. They tell us they'll show kind of more ads from campaigns, but the library doesn't work very well. We need much, much more information than they're prepared to give. They're kind of giving ads and spend. We need to know who they were targeted at. Was it successful? Fact checkers, God bless them, they operate in the dark. I mean, for them to do efficient fact checking, they need to know who exactly is seeing an anti-vax you know, content saying that you shouldn't vaccinate your kids. What kind of success does it have? Is it even worth targeting that piece of disinformation, or should they go for another? I mean, we live in the dark, and that is a demand for more information, which is in line with freedom of expression. So I do think there is a liberal way out of the world that we're in. All that will do is help level up the playing field. You know, that won't change everything. If people want to be Nazis, they still can be Nazis. They still want to do stupid things, they can still do stupid things. But it will at least give the chance for those who want to fight for factual discourse, but more importantly, who want to fight for kind of like a society where we can still all talk to each other, can compete. And it'll slow down, you know, the way campaigns are being run currently, which I think is not very good for our democracy.
Do you think that there is, and slightly to play devil's advocate here, but in some cases it strikes me that what is quite mundane political procedure is dressed up as some sort of political alchemy in the interest of the people doing these things? You know, Cambridge Analytica aren't actually, you know, these wizards of politics.
Without a doubt. I mean, in my book, the book is stuffed full of interviews with different types of, should we call them propagandists? No, and throughout the book, I'm kind of going, can I really believe these guys? You know, can I? So I do actually interview the guy who created the company above Cambridge Analytica, SCL, which was the original company.
Nigel Oakes.
Who I'm actually known for, you know, I've met him before because SCL sort of operate and think about Russia and defensey things, and that's something I've been thinking about as well. And he was brutally honest. He said, look, I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the interview's in the book, but basically I think he was saying that the idea that you could do at scale, in quick time, accurate behavioural change, psychological profiling online by analysing people's likes and shares was, I think the word is bollocks. So he does have a methodology, but it's the opposite of alchemy. It's very kind of as close to scientific as he thinks you can get. We spend years developing it. And he focuses very much on behavioral change as opposed to attitudinal change, which is one of the big debates in propaganda. Do you try to change people's minds or their behavior? And he's really concerned with the latter. And he's saying, no, you can do it. He spent years and really decades trying to work it out. And it involves very, very deep anthropological research, sending sort of people into a community to do kind of social survey work, which doesn't even feel like social survey work. It has to be very, very natural and very, very organic. And you're trying to work out what drives behavior. And there's many, many factors to it. So it's the opposite of alchemy. His argument is that I'm trying to get this to be a science as much as possible. But, you know, again, the actions of somebody like a Cambridge Analytica and the reason they can provide so much, you know, do this rhetoric that has a hocus-pocus element to it is the lack of transparency. Because, you know, the big thing that they were really caught doing is using a huge amount of personal Facebook data. And the fact that we didn't know about that, the fact that Damian Collins had to call Facebook, then call Cambridge Analytica until finally, you know, this came out after a long period of denial, that's the problem. You know, we're kind of, by having a system in the dark, it allows, you know, even these fears of the Kremlin's kind of like, you know, all-pervasive influence, it allows that to be augmented. So rather than a really kind of evidence-based discussion about what Putin is up to or Cambridge Analytica are up to, we end up living in semi-darkness. And that's no good for anyone. It's not that hard to change. I just think there's a little bit of reluctance by all political sides to do it because, you know, they all know it's wrong, but they have kind of planned their next set of campaigns around this.
Well, we're about to see.
I know, exactly. But this is the depressing thing. We're about to have another election, and virtually nothing has changed since 2016 and 17. We're still going to be able to see all these non-transparent campaigns. I mean, there's been a bit of self-regulations from the tech platforms, and obviously Twitter have just said they're not going to allow paid political ads on their platform. But a lot of the stuff isn't paid. A lot of the stuff is covert. You know, I think it's good they've done that, but that's just one tiny slice of the problem. So we're going to look, what's the real problem with all of this? When you have these campaigns in the dark, when we don't understand who's really behind them, when we don't actually see all the campaigns because they're being targeted at different groups, then we end up with the result that we've struggled to analyze. And we're still trying to understand, why did people vote for Brexit? Was it animal rights? Was it sovereignty? Was it immigration? I mean, there's no agreement because we didn't actually see the campaign. It was in completely dark corners of the internet. So we struggle to then really understand why as a society we've made decisions, which means we can't have that kind of minimal level of trust that you need for democracy to survive. And I'm just really worried we're going to enter another election now, which is meant to clear things up, and we'll end up even more befuddled than before. And we won't have this sense of closure, which, you know, we probably need. It's really sad that no regulation was passed. I mean, I really thought that we'd get at least sort of basic electoral regulation before the next vote.
Which I suppose, ironically, is a casualty of Brexit itself.
So we're just stuck in this loop of not knowing why.
The Brexit doom loop in terms of legislation.
You're right. Yeah, because firstly, nobody wants to litigate. Nobody wants to relitigate Brexit for understandable reasons. But everyone wants sort of resolution, but we're not really creating a playing field where resolution could happen.
Yeah, it's something we've sort of had on the site in a few articles, is this idea that a referendum provides finality, or it's epitomised by the phrase clean Brexit, which I just think is crazy. I mean, just picking up on something you just said, I mean, about it being a fixable problem, and there's a lot of kind of catastrophism about these days. And one thing in your latest book is that you meet some of the good guys. And I mean, what are they doing to combat this? I'm thinking of there's a guy in Serbia, for example.
Sure. So exactly. So the regulation helps us create a level playing field. It won't solve. I mean, that's all it will do. So at the end of the day, we'll have to compete. By we, I mean those who believe in kind of a democracy based on genuine debate and let's call it deliberative democracy, in want of a better term, as opposed to those who kind of want to spread forms of discourse, hateful ones or conspiracy-filled ones, which kind of break down the possibility of any kind of interaction. So let's say that's what I mean by good and bad. So I mean, a lot of people who are still very excited by the possibilities of data and the possibilities of the internet. And nasty internet campaigns do the following. They analyze groups online, but they do it in a sneaky way, in a non-transparent way. And then they feed them bits of content that will heighten polarization, usually, and heighten hatred. Because that's a good, pretty effective way to get people to do stuff. Now, we could actually be analysing the internet and doing the absolute opposite. We could be analysing different social groups and thinking about, okay, what are the underlying values they have in common? How do we create content that whose success we measure, not through likes and shares, which usually equal kind of like hate and enmity, but measure it through how much constructive discourse it managed to foster or how much trust it inspired. So there's other ways of measuring what we do. The problem is that wouldn't immediately be financially profitable. So we probably need some sort of public service remit for this kind of content. So we're moving towards kind of like a BBC-like thinking for the digital age, which is very different to the old broadcast model. And I meet all sorts of people in the book who are trying very interesting things. So I meet a guy in Mexico who organizes protest movements. And he sort of thinks that you can tell a society's kind of latent desires for social change and progress by analyzing sort of Google searches and a few other data points. So the same way that Google could tell that there was a flu epidemic building somewhere through the searches people were using on their platform. He says that you can analyze sort of desires for social change in the same way. And really the internet could provide us with a connection with what, as a society, we really want and are interested in. I mean, that has fascinating kind of consequences. That could mean that newspapers or media don't have to necessarily follow politicians, but could sort of try to understand what people really, really care about and are really concerned with. It means people could connect with each other, like and form new alliances for change that they weren't even aware of, because social groups that we didn't even think had anything in common with might have very similar concerns. So there's a big possibility as long as it's done in a transparent and ethical way. And he saw like the real problem with all these bots and trolls and all this kind of like this huge amount of deceptive content online was that it was kind of standing between us and the revolutionary potential of society, which is hidden in our data. He's Mexican, so he talks in a Mexican kind of Trotsky kind of way always. It's just part of the Mexican discourse. But I think every party in Mexico has got revolutionary in it somewhere. And so that was the great danger, that the internet provided this incredible moment for us to understand ourselves better and to develop. And the problem with all this digital deceit was that it was standing in the way of that. So we're kind of becoming alienated from ourselves. Again, look, these are all people who are, I don't think any one of them has kind of a final solution, but they're at least all still excited by the potential that the internet offers. I mean, I don't think we can retreat to the old world. I don't think we can go back to Walter Cronkite or Jeremy Paxman sort of saying, this is the truth. I do think we're out of that paradigm now, for better or worse. So I don't think I don't think we'll go back to the old deliberative democracy. I think that has broken for many reasons.
Well, I mean, my final question really is the things you talked about. I mean, we know they're bad, and we know that they exist to some degree or other. But I wonder what you think might be the next iteration of this of this sort of social media disinformation problem.
I mean, the one that everybody talks about is sort of deep fakes and videos that look completely real, but are actually fake. And there are risks that can come from that. Maybe the main one is actually that people just stop trusting anything. So it's this lack of trust, which is kind of becoming very corrosive. Not that people are so stupid to believe stuff, but actually they just stop trusting anything. And trust is just so necessary for democracy. Because, you know, if the only solution then is a strong man leader who can, like, you know, guide us through this murky world, which is the argument that the Putins and the Xi Jinpings of this world make. So that, you know, that continuing lack of trust is a very big problem. But the other big one is the AI that we mentioned. So then, you know, I think we're about to have this huge and maybe very productive debates about the ethics of artificial intelligence and what do we mean by control and what is good and bad and how do we keep a sense of the human in all of this. I suppose underlying this is really an existential fear that we are just data. I mean, like, we can be just analyzed through our data and the algorithms will find us our ideal wives and our ideal shoes and our ideal sexual position and our own kind of complete dissolution into data. There's kind of this, you know, thing, sort of existential concern that the idea of the human is being undermined. And paradoxically, the more we express ourselves online, the more data there is about us, you know, our grammar, the way we use language and so on, which all gives us clues, gives the computers huge, more clues about who we are. So what's breaking, very interestingly, is the connection between self-expression and the idea of the human and emancipation. It always used to be that the more you speak, the more you express yourself, the more, you know, the more free you are, whether that's in jazz or rock and roll or modernist literature, you know, or just this whole idea we had of self-expression equals being human. And now the more you express yourself, the more you can be manipulated, you know, the more of yourself you give up. And that's a shocking idea. So I really enjoyed Jonah Kavanagh's novel Zed, which came out this year as well, which I think is a very interesting partner to my book, which is kind of a dystopia, a comedy dystopia set in a world where algorithms do everything for us. But the lovely trick she does is that it's a comedy because actually we're not algorithms, and there's a great character in the book who's like a Mark Zuckerberg character who's like trained all these algorithms to find himself the perfect woman and he never can. And I wonder whether the new idea of the human that's going to develop in this sort of discussion we're about to have about AI is going to be ourselves, our human selves, is that which algorithms can't predict. So that's where we're going to exist, in that gap between the algorithm and the actual lived experience. Now, and then there's sort of various kind of like ethical things to think about as well, but maybe we can dwell on that as well.
All right. Well, on that salutary note, I'm going to bid you farewell. Thanks very much indeed for joining us, Peter. And This Is Not Propaganda is available in all good bookshops. And
Yeah, on Kindle.
On Amazon via a good algorithm.
Yeah, look, it's probably already here. It'll give you a bunch of other books to read straight away.
Exactly, including
including Zed.
Nothing is real and everything is possible.
Yes.
All right. Thanks very much, Peter. Take care.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.